100. Yeshua is not as widely learned, even though it's first, and I think the simple reason why is because it's like not as complex, I think, is the popular conception, right? You don't have the same conflict, complexity, Shaul, David, you know, the what's going on with Gidon or Shimshon, right? It's a great book, you know, we come into the land, what's the worst thing that happens, you know, there's one guy who takes some money from Jericho, you know, we signed a treaty that maybe we shouldn't have, otherwise, the book is smooth, we win our battles, we follow the mitzvos, you know, we have a good leader, it's, everything is great. So I thought that was nice, because, like, you know, one thing we don't really need right now is a book that rips into, you know, gives us, like, harsh criticism. It's nice to learn the Sefer, which is just all the nice things that happened before it all went downhill. But as we'll see, there's, like, so much going on. So not only was I excited that we learned Yehoshua, I was excited because I got the Prakim, which are all about military conquest, which I think is the, you know, it's the, I'm going to claim it's the real core of the book. So without further ado, let's start going through some of the sources that I put together. There are three basic sections to the shiur for tonight. The first is the shortest, and that's just going to be a little bit of background on Yehoshua's personality, kind of building off on some of what Orah taught last week. Section two of the shiur is going to be, we'll try to do a broad overview of the battles in the Prakim, which we are studying. And then the third part of the shiur is going to be try to dive a little bit in depth to the whole section of Jericho, because I think that there are some real pivotal themes going on in that first major battle between Yehoshua and between the Kenanim. Okay, so with those words of introduction, let's begin. So we start with source one, which is maybe surprisingly not a source from Sefer Yehoshua. Does anyone know what this this is? This is the last, the very last of the brachot that Moshe gives. It's actually the last thing that Moshe says before he goes up to Har Nevo. If you remember on Simchas Torah, so this is the conclusion of Moshe's brachot. And he says, "Ashracha Yisrael mi kamocha, praiseworthy is Israel, who is like you." It's amazing, after Moshe's whole career with Bnei Yisrael, the last thing he says is, you know, praise for Israel. "Am nosha b'ashem, a people delivered by the Lord. Magein ezracha, your protecting shield. V'asher charev gavasacha, your sword triumphant. V'kachashu aivecha lach be'ata alba mosei mosidroch. Your enemies shall come cringing before you," according to the 1917 JPS translation, "and you shall tread on their backs." So that's a bit of a surprising last bracha for Moshe to give. This, you know, military, like, we're not really a militaristic religion. We're not one that particularly enthuses about conquest and crushing our enemies. So why is this the last thing that Moshe says before he goes up on Har Nevo, right? Literally, the next pasuk is tells us, you know, Vaya'al Moshe, that Moshe ascends to Har Nevo. So you take a look at Rashi, and Rashi tells you that these two brachot that Moshe gives, his parting word, is actually him foreseeing some of the events that we learned this past week in Yehoshua. V'kachashu aivecha lach. What does that refer to? The enemies, you know, submitting to you. So Rashi says this is Moshe anticipating what's going to happen with the Givonim, right? This group in chapter 9 in Yehoshua, who you know, come and sign a treaty under somewhat dubious circumstances, right? That's one category. V'kachashu aivecha lach. That is Givon. V'ata alba mosei mosidroch. What does this refer to? So Rashi explains, this is when Yehoshua tells his army in chapter 10, after they capture the five enemy kings in the south, simu es ragleichem al savrei malachem ha'ela, put your feet on their necks, really. So Moshe's last bracha then is anticipating, you know, a core component of Yehoshua's career. Last week, Orah talked about Yehoshua as somebody who follows in Moshe's footsteps, right? He's the quintessential student, the ultimate student, personality, career, choices, priorities, right? So much follows Moshe, and so much is trying to live up to Moshe. There's another side of the coin, which is that Yehoshua is also somebody who's different. Yehoshua is not primarily a Navi. Yehoshua is primarily somebody who is a Kovesh. The Midrash says in source number 2, Moshe Rosh Linaviyim, Moshe is the chief of the prophets, Yehoshua Rosh LaKovshim, and Yehoshua is the chief of the conquerors. That's where this the Shir title comes from tonight. And Moshe's last word as he leaves is anticipating this key part of Yehoshua's career. So the stuff that we're reading this week, the Prakim and Yehoshua about conquest, really are the core of Yehoshua. This is the conquest of the land. And so one of the things we want to do is see, you know, what are some key things that this is teaching us, besides just that, you know, something generic we know, Hashem was with B'nai Israel did well, and everything worked out. Right? We're going to see some more to that. So one last piece on Yehoshua. So who is Yehoshua? Who do we know him as? Jump in.
Huh. One of the Meraglim.
One of the Meraglim, for sure. Why do we think he was chosen as one of the Meraglim?
He's Moshe's right hand.
Excellent. Right? Maybe he got in because he's Moshe's right hand. So he's a spy, close relationship with Moshe. Do you know anything else about him, about his career in the Chumash? When are we first introduced to him? Sorry? Mishari Moshe, but even before then, Mishari Moshe, we only see at Kitisa.
In Amalek.
Amalek, very good, right? Yehoshua is the general, which is kind of random, right? We've never been introduced to Yehoshua before, but he leads the troops against Amalek. So he's a spy, he's a general, and he's Moshe's right hand man. Close attendant. So two of those things go together, and one of them doesn't really fit. I understand him being a spy, and I understand him being a military commander. That sounds like Yehoshua has military background, leadership background. Him being Moshe's attendant doesn't really seem to fit. And there's a piece in Divrei Hayamim, source number 3, which really sheds some fascinating light on who Yehoshua was. Because Dirayam tells us about the ancestry of, or the descendants of Ephraim. And we're told about a couple of sons. And then we have right here, source number 3, La Dan Bino. Maybe I should mute unless jumping in. Because I'm just hearing a little bit of scratching. Hopefully it's not for me. But can I even do that? I think I can. So Yehoshua, right? So the Dirayam says, "La Dan Bino." I think I might. I guess since I'm the host, but I don't really want to. You know, it's quiet now, so maybe let's tentatively keep it in for now. Because I would love to have participation if we can. Okay. So what does Dirayam say? "La Dan Bino, Amihud Bino, Elishama Bino, Nun Bino, Yehoshua Bino." So we have here Yehoshua from the tribe of Ephraim. His father is Nun. So this is our Yehoshua that we know and love. And who's Yehoshua's grandfather? Elishama, and his great-grandfather is Amihud. Does any of those names ring a bell?
No.
Elishama or Amihud? No bell. So I was trying to save sources because I felt bad putting so many on, so I skimped on this one. But Elishama ben Amihud... Might ring a faint bell, because when we get up to Sefer Bamidbar, and we're not gonna... why did my screen get...
One of the Nasiim.
One of the Nasiim, correct. He is the Nasi to Shevet... he is the Nasi to Shevet Ephraim. Which means that Yehoshua is...
Royal.
Is the grandson... Yeah, he's the grandson of the Nasi. Which is amazing. So he's the grandson of the Nasi of Ephraim. Now I understand why he's a military leader, right? He's a general in the beginning. He's chosen as one of the Meraglim. The Meraglim are all, we're told, you know, from prominent families of the tribes. What's actually surprising about Yehoshua is not that he becomes the leader after being Moshe's assistant. What's surprising about Yehoshua is that he became Moshe's attendant despite being from one of the most prominent families in all of Am Yisrael. So Yehoshua really has deep in his his background, it seems like, leadership and military potential. He goes off the traditional career track by attaching himself so closely to Moshe Rabbeinu. In that regard, honestly, he's kind of similar to Moshe himself. Moshe, who is raised in Paro's palace, then goes from there to total career shift, right, off in Midian, and then comes back at the end of his life to lead Am Yisrael. So when we think about Yehoshua, we really should appreciate that he is really made to be a conqueror. Okay, so that's one important piece of just general introduction in Sefer Yehoshua. One last thing before we dive into the next part of this year. I photocopied this map over here from the Atlas Dot Mikra. It's a fantastic book. I actually got it as a bar mitzvah present. We need to appreciate one small thing about the geography of Israel, and then we can continue. Israel, why does this keep on happening? I might need to change to a new computer. I'm sorry. Yeah, my computer is old. I'm going to try to not touch it as much as possible. That's what we'll do. Okay, everyone sees what I have up on the screen here. I have the map, right? You see basically the north of Israel. Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Now it moved again. Ah, what am I going to do with this? I am going to have to... whatever. We'll make it work. If you can, I suppose, I shared the file in through chats. It might be more productive to open it through there because this computer is clearly glitching like crazy. Everyone just take a minute, open up the file that I shared in chats because the screen share technique is not going to work, and then we'll continue.
Okay.
I shared it in chat. Is it? It's not there. It should be in chats.
Sure.
It's
on the screen now.
Let me share it one more.
Now look at the screen. Look at the screen.
Yeah, no, I know it's on the screen. The problem is my computer keeps on jumping around. I sent it to everybody. So now you can just download it. And you don't need to worry about my hoppy glitchy computer situation.
You have to learn something here. What you're doing, you
know, okay?
Never lose it. You will get it.
Okay. Okay. So does everyone see the file got sent through?
Yeah. Go ahead. Let's keep it on. We're good.
Okay. So hopefully everyone has it, and then I won't. I'll keep on trying to screen share, but if you can use the file itself, that'll be better.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we think about the geography of Israel, and that's going to be pivotal for understanding Yehoshua's conquest. So there are four primary geographic regions that we always have to have in mind, and they go vertically. In the far west of Israel, we have the Chof Hayam, right? We have the coastal plain. It's flat, it's fertile, it's easy to invade, and that's where the international roads are, right? When Paro wants to go fight against Bavel, and he asks Yoshiyahu for permission, you know, he wants to go fight a war, so you know that Yoshiyahu is going to go fight him in the he's going to fight him in the plains, right? Because Paro is going to go up here, and then he's going to go. The plain continues in Emek Yisrael. It's going to go over there. So that's you have the plain, right? It's basically, up here and over here. That's geographic area number one. If we continue over eastward, and now we have the Shvela. And this is we call the low hills, right? Israel, the elevation is beginning. You don't have mountains yet, but. But you have, but it's getting higher. In the center of the country, you have the mountains, right? Hare Yehuda in the south, Har Ephraim, which comes up all the time in Tanakh, farther in the north. That's region number three. That's where a whole bunch of the battles in Yehoshua are going to take place. And then finally, what's the last thing you have before you get to the Jordan River, right? All the way over in the east is you have the Jordan River Valley, right? The Arava, the Kikar, depending on what type, what part of the country we're talking about. So you have flat hills, mountain, flat. That's the basic situation. So when Yehoshua wants to conquer the country, this is what he has to deal with. He's coming in from Eiver HaYarden, and so the first thing he's going to do is figure out some, right. He has to get into the mountains. So how is he going to get there? So if you go down to page source number 5, this is another one of the maps that they have, and this is a map which is going to diagram out the campaigns in the south. So it really helps make Yeshua's basic plan very clear. He comes in, they cross the Jordan River over here. Here's Gilgal. Gilgal is their very first base. It's pretty clear why this is the case, because Yericho is along a riverbed which leads you straight east, and then you can go south to Yerushalayim, right? If you could walk Wadi Kelt. So that takes you, right? That takes you right to Yericho. So he's going to come in at Yericho. That's the first city that has to fall. Chazal, I have it here in source number 6. Call it the key to Eretz Yisrael. Yericho was Nagra Shel Eretz Yisrael. That's the real key to the conquest, is Yericho. Once you have that, now you can walk, and now you can march in. You have an excellent way into the mountains, going west. Next up, he's going to conquer the Ai, right? Which is right, I'm trying to share the screen sharing it right now, right over here. What happens after Ai? So then Givon capitulates. If you look at the map, we can understand why Givon capitulates, because they would have been next up, right after the Ai. Here's Givon down here, and then you have the cities which the map has next to Givon are the other Givonite cities. So they make a treaty with Yehoshua. So now he's made a serious inroad into the west of the country. Dat Mikra thinks that at this time they also take over a whole bunch of Har Ephraim. Now what's going to happen? So in Perek Yud, the Navi tells us the king of Yerushalayim panics. We can understand why Yerushalayim panics, because he's up next, right? If Yehoshua went, you know, Yericho, Ai, Givon, so Yerushalayim is up next. So he brings together a few kings in the south. They are going to march north against Givon, right? And Yehoshua is going to fight them there. It's going to be a disaster for the south. Yehoshua wins. Yehoshua wins a very quick battle. And then in Perek Yud Aleph, the scene shifts to the north. So that's the overall just map of where the battles take place. The Dat Mikra commentary, and I think it makes a lot of sense. I kind of was thinking the same thing. I want to flesh out a little bit what they suggest. Argues that there's also a clear strategy that Yehoshua seems to be trying to pull off. There are 31 Canaanite kings that Yehoshua is going to fight, right? There's a song at the end of the part we learned this week, which goes through all of them. So you have a bunch of these petty, competing, warring, you know, city-states, some, you know, you have a city in the middle, there's some land around it. They're a more advanced society. And so the best way to fight them would be, you know, Yehoshua, his major accomplishment in leadership is he's able to keep B'nai Yisrael together, right, and go to Shoftim after Yehoshua, and we see how hard that is to keep, you know, all these tribes together. You know, even Devorah comes close, but she's not able to get all of them. No one else really even comes close to what she does in Sefer Shoftim. So Yehoshua is united. His goal is going to be, so if he can prevent the Canaanim from coming together, right? If he can deal with them piece by piece, which he's totally able to do. So one major way in which he pulls that off is he cuts the country in half, right? If you invade in the middle of the country, and then you, bang, go straight into the west, so now you've cut off the south from the north. And you can see the importance of that, because in source number 7, bottom of page 3, so what happens after the conquest of the Ai? The Navi says that all the kings all over Canaan, north, south, east, and west, begin to try to come together to develop an alliance. Now, they never actually pull it off, right? Because in the Navi tells us in Perek Tes, they had an agreement to come together to fight Yehoshua, but it doesn't actually happen. What we actually see are two distinct alliances. One, an alliance in the south, in the beginning of Perek Yud, and another one, an alliance in the north, in the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. The alliance in the north is much more powerful. It seems like what happens is, Yehoshua cuts them off from each other. That now prevents effective communication. So the kings in the south quickly get together. Yehoshua fights them, wins a very quick battle. Navi tells us that Yehoshua's victory in the south, where he conquers Hebron and Lachish and a bunch of the cities in the south, happens very quickly. And that's critical because he's in a two-front war, right? He has to worry about the south and the north. So he handles the south very quickly, and then he's able to turn north and face the coalition that is developing up there. We have a similar phenomenon later on in the Navi in Shmuel Bet, where Yoav ben Tsruya, right, David's general, is facing the alliance of Aram up in the north and Ammon down in the south. And so what Yoav does, he splits his army and he tells his brother Avishai, right, you take the south, I'll take the north, and we are going to have to move our forces very rapidly to handle the two different groups. So what Yehoshua is able to do, by cutting off the country, he's able to prevent them from effectively communicating. And then we understand why it's so important that he beats the south quickly. Okay? That's a key part of the overall strategy. And in a minute, I want to talk about why it's important for us to know this. So besides strategy, like how does Yehoshua conquer the country? And the answer seems to be, he cuts it in half, takes out the south, then takes out the north, and then spends a lot of time, you know, going city by city. So we also see, in almost every battle that Yehoshua fights, we see very clear military tactics that Yehoshua is engaging in. He is not simply relying on Hashem to just take care of business for him. There's real military leadership and ingenuity that needs to be deployed. When he fights against the Ai, so what's the technique there? Hashem tells him to do it, right? Yehoshua is kind of like the quarterback, and he's getting the message through the helmet, and Hashem telling him what to do. But it's a complex maneuver. They set up an ambush. Then Yehoshua later on sets up a second ambush. Then the main army approaches the city. They perform a fake retreat, which is very difficult to do, and Yehoshua has to lead the army, which is pretending to retreat, to draw out the enemy forces from the Ai. And then as soon as the enemies have been drawn out of the city, Yehoshua gives the signal. He holds his spear up in the air. The ambushing party comes forward and charges into the city. Yehoshua has his army turn around, stop their retreat, and fight. And the maneuver is successful. It's very difficult, right? A combination of two ambushes. You've got to coordinate like three different armies. You have to have your own army have enough faith in you that they're going to pretend to run away but not actually run away. That's the technique that Yehoshua deploys when he's fighting the Ai. Later on, if we move down to source number 11, the next major battle is against the kings in the south. What happens there? We're told in Pasuk Tet that Yehoshua leads his whole army on a night march. They march all night brutal march. It's like more than 20 miles. I tried Google Mapsing it. That's what I basically came up with. And they take the enemy totally by surprise because the enemy did not expect them to show up then at all. So it's perfectly timed. They seem to come at daybreak. Again, we see Yehoshua's leadership, right? He has to get his whole army to sign up on an all-night march. And at this point, they're marching to defend, you know, these Givonim who just tricked them one parak ago. But Yehoshua is able to hold it together. That's the main tactic, and it totally works, right? The enemies are panicked. It seems like a combination because they didn't expect Yehoshua to show up. And then Hashem chips in, right? Hashem makes them panic even more. And then once again, you know, as Yehoshua and his army pursue the fleeing Canaanim, Hashem chips in again by sending hailstones. Right, which doesn't give Bnei Yisrael the victory. They got the victory because they showed up and marched all night and took them by total surprise. It helps give them a strategic victory, right? Because it helps them actually destroy the enemy on the field. You know, you think back to the Yom Kippur War. So it's one thing to surround, you know, the third Egyptian army in the Sinai Desert. You can win a tactical victory. But then you have, you know, the question is, will you be able to actually wipe out the army, or is it going to live to fight another day? In the case of Egypt, it didn't matter because we signed a peace treaty. But in the case of Yeshua, he has to finish this off, and that's where Hashem gives him help. Last case in source number 12. So we're told here, this is Yeshua's last battle. It's against the kings in the north. The kings in the north are equipped with horses and chariots, which the Bnei Israel do not have at all. I didn't really understand. I was in the course of praying this year. I never really understood what was the point of chariots. It turns out that what we think of as cavalry in an army didn't really exist until after the time of Tanakh. They didn't have horses that were big enough to support soldiers with armor. So your chariots, right, where you have a couple of horses together, which are, you know, pulling a wheeled cart, and it has soldiers on it with bows and arrows. So chariots were effectively the only military cavalry that you that were there. If you're only infantry, so how can you defeat cavalry? On the open battle plain, you don't have a chance, right? Because they're fast and you're slow, and they can just shoot arrows at you and charge you or retreat, and there's nothing really you can do. So the best thing you can do is if you could somehow get very, very close. Right, if you can get right next to them, then you've neutralized their advantage. So how does Yeshua do that? So the Navi says in Pasuk Zion, source number 12, once again, Yeshua, they march, they take them by surprise, another sneak attack, and they're able to get into the enemy camp before the enemy is even aware. And that's how they're able to defeat the enemy in the north. So every single one of these battles against the Ai, against the south, and against the north involves creative tactics. It involves effective leadership. He has to get the people to sign up for these risky plans. And then now we need to ask is who cares? Right, so it's very interesting. As like a military historian, you know, we can analyze the what's going on in Yehoshua's generalship. But what's this doing in Tanakh? So there are a couple of things. First of all, let's think back to the battles in the Chumash. You know, Moshe leads Bnei Israel. They fight Amalek. They fight Og. They fight Sichon. They fight Midian. We're not told a thing. We're really not told a single thing about any military tactic whatsoever. Right? And none of those battles. We're just told, you know, they went to war and Bnei Israel won. Right? Okay. In Amalek, Moshe held up his arms. We're not told a single tactic. If you were a military historian, you would learn zero about, you know, what Moshe's general techniques were, or what Yehoshua when he's or Pinchas when he's leading the army. The Chumash tells you absolutely nothing about how Bnei Israel fight. The reason is very simple. It doesn't matter, because how do Bnei Israel win their battles in the Chumash when they're in the desert and they have the clouds of glory and they have Moshe Rabbeinu and they have the Shechina? It's as we say in we take out the Torah, right? Vayihi b'tzaron, vayomer Hashem, kuma Hashem v'yafutzu ayvecha mipanecha. That's the experience in the desert. Hashem just drives away the enemies. It's a miraculous victory every single time. The tactics don't matter because Hashem is doing all the fighting for us. But what happens in Yehoshua is the book of transition. That is Yehoshua's task, right? How is he going to get these people, and this is what Ora talked about also last week, how do we get these people from living in a world of supernatural, miraculous existence to living in a world where they're in Eretz Yisrael? It's a land which Hashem always pays attention to, right? It's a land that's under divine providence, but it's one where the laws of nature have resumed their natural course. And what has to happen is you have to have the combination that Yehoshua is able to strike. You have to have the natural techniques. You have to have the military creativity and the energy and the leadership and the tactics. And you also have to have the faith, and you also have to have the intervention and the aid from Hashem. That's why the Navi has to make clear what Yeshua's tactics are. It does matter. There is an actual religious message to this, right? And the message is that Yeshua has to be able to strike this combination. In fact, there's a clear double pattern in the battles in the Prakim that we learned this past week. On the one hand, the Hashem's involvement decreases every single time. So if we think about Yericho, and in like 5 minutes we'll look at Yericho a little more in depth. So in Yericho, almost everything, basically everything, is done by Hashem. Hashem gives Yahushua the battle plan. And what do the Jews do? They walk around 7 times following the Luchot and following the Kohanim, and they don't do anything, right? It's an open miracle. The walls collapse. They seem to sink in by themselves. It seems like it's not the entire wall which collapsed, only part of the wall. That way, the Yericho is trapped inside, but also Rachav's house stays intact. But it's just miraculous from top to bottom. You get to battle number 2 against the Ai, and now here you have Hashem telling Yehoshua what to do. But Yehoshua now has to actually do it, right? He has to have the ambush, and he has to set up the feigned withdrawal. You get to the third battle against the south, and now the Navi actually tells you it's not clear that Hashem ever told Yehoshua anything. Yehoshua decides to go to war. Some of the Mefarshim say he asked the Urim V'Tumim, but that's not clear in the Pesukim at all. Yehoshua's initiative is to go fight the war. It's his battle plan. And what Hashem does now is Hashem helps in achieving a strategic victory towards the end. Right? Hashem gives the miraculous assistance once the enemy is already retreating. But here already Yehoshua is the one who is devising the entire battle plan. And then you get to the last major battle against the north, and here there's no open miracle whatsoever. It's Yahushua's plan, it's Yahushua's battle. The Navi tells us that Hashem helped, you know, bring about the victory, but there's not even an open miracle this time. All there is regular Hashgacha Pratit, divine providence. So we have this clear pattern, a decline in the miraculous, and Yahushua having to do more and more every single battle. At the same time, if we think about the enemy that Yehoshua faces, we can argue that actually as Hashem's involvement decreases, the enemies become more and more of a threat. It's counterintuitive. Like, I would think that I would need more divine assistance for the stronger enemies, but Yehoshua actually gets less. So what's the first army he fights is Yericho, and Yericho is a total basket case, right? They're panicked, they've locked the doors, they've locked the gates, they're completely, they've lost all and any will to fight whatsoever. They place their faith in their walls, and that's why their walls come down, but as an effective enemy fighting force, they're nothing, right? I mean, if Yericho actually wanted to fight, they should have tried to stop the Jews from crossing the Jordan River, but they don't do that. Right, they've almost given in. They've given up from the beginning. The next enemy is the Ai, which fights, and they have fighting spirit. But the Navi tells us time and time again, the Ai is like a rinky-dink little town. Right, I mean, they got a nice wall, but like they're not a major regional power. I mean, I think archaeologists are still trying to figure out where exactly the Ai is. You know, the different candidates, but it was not a major city by any stretch. What comes up next? You have the army coalition in the south. So now already this is, you're talking, you know, this is all the major cities in the south of Eretz Yisrael coming together to fight a war. That is a larger threat. And then the last battle that Yehoshua fights against the kings in the north is clearly the biggest threat of all. This is the one where for the first time they have horses and chariots. It seems like multiple kings from different regions in the north. And it's Dafka, the most challenging battle, where Yehoshua has the least amount of miraculous assistance to go on. So you think about what that means for Yehoshua's leadership ability, right? Bnei Yisrael come in being used to everything that happened under Moshe Rabbeinu, and they're maintaining their bitachon, and they're still getting divine assistance, but they're getting less and less with every single battle, and the enemies are getting more and more difficult. And yet Yeshua is able to keep the people together, and he's able to keep the people having faith. He's able to wean them off of what they had in the desert and bring them into what life is supposed to be like in Eretz Canaan. Two just closing sources when we think about that last major battle that Yeshua fights in the north, the one with the least amount of divine intervention, or it's no longer miraculous, and the major threat that it was. So one, just a pasuk, and one, a comment by the Radak. The Radak's comment is on the pasuk, which tells us that after Yeshua won, right, so they just beat this whole army with chariots, so Hashem said, you have to hamstring the horses, which is also a commandment in Sefer Dvarim. So why did they have to hamstring the horses? So Radak says, because what did the Canaanim think? They thought, that classic phrase. They did not know, the enemy did not know, that the horse does not provide salvation. And that message has to be driven into Bnei Israel as they get closer and closer to fighting in the natural world. They need that reminder, right, that it is not the horse or the chariot that provides salvation. Ultimately, it still is Hashem. In addition, this last pasuk, source number 13, tells us, summing up the wars in the north, Yamim Rabim, Asan Yeshua's Kol HaMelachim La'ilam Melchama, that while the battle in the south happens very quickly, battle in the north is not easy. By no means should we think that Yeshua fights a couple of wars, he has a couple of miracles, and it's all easy and good. The battles in the north take a long time, it's a dangerous enemy, and it's some of Yeshua's greatness that he's able to keep the people together, able to keep them fighting, and able to keep them having faith. So that's an overall, bird's eye view of the conquest in the Prakim that we learned this past week. Yeshua's dual challenge of keeping the people together as they transition from the world of the miraculous, and at the same time, right, while the enemies become stronger and stronger, realize that Hashem is still with them, even though the laws of nature are not being transformed as they had been under Moshe's tenure and even in the beginning of Yeshua's. Okay, so that's the second major part that I wanted to do, and the overall bird's eye view of the section that we learned. So the time remaining to us, I want to zoom in on three themes, if we can, hopefully, in the battle against Yericho, which is the very first of the battles that Yeshua leads Bnei Yisrael in. If you take a look at sources 14 and 15, so this is on page number 7. So I put side by side the beginning of the battle against the Yericho passage with, like, one of the most famous passages in the Chumash, right? With Moshe's vision of the burning bush. If you recall, technically this does not fall under my learning assignment, because I was given chapters 6 through 12. But it's not our fault that whoever divided the chapters did a bad job, because the end of chapter 5 in Yehoshua really belongs with the beginning of chapter 6. Because what happened at the end of chapter 5? So Yehoshua is in Yericho. He's not in literal Yericho, right? He's in the area of Yericho, not the city itself. And he sees, right? He sees this ish omed l'negdo v'charbash lufa b'yado. He sees a man facing him with his sword drawn. We know who is this man, but it turns out it's a malach. It's the head of Hashem's army. He tells Yeshua, take off his shoe because you're on holy ground, and then it transitions to now Hashem tells Yeshua what to do against Yericho. There are very, very clear parallels between this, Yeshua's vision of the Malach, and Moshe's vision at the burning bush. Once again, you have a case of someone, Moshe is also told, he has this vision. He's immediately told to take off his shoes because he stands on holy ground. And in a couple minutes, I'm going to come back to what that holy ground is. But what's going on? In both cases, what is the symbol? So the burning bush symbolizes Bnei Yisrael. What's the symbol for Bnei Yisrael? They're burning it, and yet they're not consumed, right? And that describes the state of Israel under Egyptian bondage. That somehow, despite enduring whatever they have to endure year after year, which should have destroyed them by any rational calculation, somehow Bnei Israel is able to endure. That's what Moshe sees. He sees a vision of Bnei Israel at the time. It's the burning bush that is not consumed. What's the vision that Yehoshua sees? Again, it's a vision that symbolizes the current state of Bnei Israel. This time, it's Charba Shlufa Biyadav. This time, the people have their sword drawn, and it's time to begin conquering the land. It's the time to begin war. But there are some critical contrasts which highlight major themes in Yeshua's career generally and Yericho in particular. When Moshe's vision is obviously supernatural. Right, literally, it defies the laws of nature. A bush cannot burn and not be consumed at the same time. It's a contradiction, internally. It's a vision which just cannot be. Yehoshua's vision, not only is it perfectly natural, it's a man with his sword drawn, but the vision is so natural that what's Yehoshua's initial reaction? His initial reaction is he charges the person, or he thinks it's a person, and demands, tell me, halanu ata im letzareinu, are you in the Jewish forces, or are you in the Yericho forces? His initial assumption is that this is a soldier. So Moshe's vision is quintessentially supernatural, while Yehoshua's is thoroughly natural. So much so that he initially thinks that it's just a regular human soldier. That speaks volumes, because that says so much about the transition that's happening now, right? If we talked about the vision describing the state of Am Yisrael, so we could also say that besides the burning bush and Bnei Yisrael somehow surviving despite their oppression, they're about to see open miracles that defy the laws of nature. And that's everything that's happening in Egypt. While with Yehoshua, the theme is going to be that of Sar Tzva Hashem, the angel of Hashem. Sometimes it's obvious this is coming from on high, and sometimes it's not. But being obvious or not doesn't matter. What's critical for Yeshua to understand is that there is divine intervention. If we scroll down a little bit to some of the subsequent sources that I put in this section, so there are a couple more which just draw this basic point out some more. The symbolism of Yehoshua seeing a malach, which he confuses for a soldier. The previous pasuk before Yehoshua's vision, pasuk Yudbet, so it's the very end of source 16 on the bottom of page 8, tells us Vayeshbos haman mimacharas. The Jews run out of man. The man had a good run. The man is gone. Vayochlu mitzvat eretz Kanaan b'shana hahi. Now the Jews resume eating normal, natural food. It's the first time since the days of the Avot that they're eating, food made in Israel. And immediately after that happens, after the Navi tells us we've finished with the man, immediately after that happens is when Yehoshua has his vision. That's a fascinating point. Rashi makes another fascinating point. Source number 17. The angel tells Yehoshua, "Ata basi, now I have come." Which is a little bit of a weird thing to say, right? Now I have come. It sounds like was he expected before? Why is he telling Yehoshua, "Now I have come"? So Rashi explains this angel was around before. Rashi quotes the Malacha saying, "I was around in the days of Moshe, and Moshe didn't want me." And Rashi sends you to Shemos chapter 33, which is the aftermath of the golden calf. You scroll down, you look at what Rashi is referencing. So after the sin of the golden calf, what did Hashem tell Moshe at one stage of their long negotiation? Hashem said, okay, a deal. Not only will I not wipe out Bnei Israel, I'll even bring them into the land, and I'll give them divine assistance, but who's going to assist them? Hashem said to Moshe, you're going to be led with a malach. V'shalachti lefanecha malach. There's an angel who's going to march at the head of you. Right, Moshe says that's not acceptable. Absolutely not. I'm not settling for a malach. I want, Hashem Lichvodo Vatzmo. I want you. And Moshe wins that round once again. Hashem says, okay, fine. Right? And then we have our 40 years in the desert with Hashem leading Bnei Yisrael. Well, the ultimate hope didn't work out because we sinned in the desert. So the way we came into the land ultimately was not what Moshe had hoped for. But under Moshe's tenure, we were led by the Shekhinah itself. Now, as we come into Eretz Canaan, that original Malach is back. We are transitioning in how Hashem intervenes. There's still divine intervention, but the way it's going to feature itself is going to change. The laws of nature are going to begin to resume themselves. One last comment that I thought we should highlight in this context is a comment that the Malbim makes. Malbim is commenting on that line that the angel tells Yeshua, where he tells him, "I am the Sar Tzva Hashem. I am the general of. I am the chief of God's hosts." So that should lead to an obvious question: if Yeshua sees the chief of God's hosts, so okay, if here's the general, so where are all the troops, right? Like you don't have a general just by himself charging the city. Where's everyone else? So the Malbim says, yeah. I didn't come by myself. Lo basi yachidi, rak yeshvi yeshi tira vot machanot. There are many, there are thousands of other malachim, right? You have the entire host of God, but Yeshua can't see it. Right? Yeshua sees one malach. There are thousands of malachim. You think of, Yaakov's experience when he comes back into Eretz Canaan, and he sees all of the malachim as he leaves Lavan. So Yeshua sees one. What's the symbolism there? Is that Yeshua's generation is going to still perceive divine intervention, and sometimes it's going to be obvious. You're going to have your Yerichos, you're going to have your hailstones, but sometimes, and maybe even more prominently, the intervention will be there, and it will not be visible to the naked eye. But that doesn't make it any less real. That is the transition that has to happen under Yehoshua. So that by the end, we can have a situation where Bnei Israel are fighting their most threatening army of the whole book, and there's no overtly miraculous intervention, and yet Bnei Israel can proceed with full faith, knowing that Hashem is still intervening and on their side, even though they can no longer see it. That is some of what is being symbolized by this very first, by this vision of the Malach. The one that at the same time is so similar to Moshe's vision of the burning bush, but at the same time has so many critical differences. Okay? So that's one major piece to highlight, one theme coming out of Yericho. I'm going to look at two more. The one we'll do first. We'll take a little bit more time, and then the one at the end will go pretty quickly. It's probably something that people who've been learning the Sefer have been already picking up on, because it's really pretty clear. So you can see I have here B, right, center letter B here in the middle of page 9, Revelation at Yericho and Revelation at Sinai. There are a number of surprising connections between what happens at Yericho and what happens at Har Sinai. Before even looking at some of the sources that I put on the sheet, let's think about what we had in the last section of the Shir. Moshe sees the burning bush, and he's told, "Remove your shoes because the ground you stand on is holy." What is that holy ground that Moshe stands on? Where is Moshe when he gets that vision?
Mishkan.
Mishkan?
Yeah.
So, sort of. Sinai. The Ramban would agree.
Har Sinai,
right? He's at Chorev. He gets that vision of the burning bush at Har Sinai, and then he's told it's holy ground, and it absolutely is, and he has to, and that's where he's going to bring Bnei Israel back to. So right away, when Yeshua gets a similar vision, and he's also told to take off your shoe, and he's also told you're standing on holy ground, so that right away should connect in our minds Yericho and Har Sinai. Now a follow-up question. What makes Har Sinai holy? It's not in Eretz Yisrael, right? There's no Kiddushat HaAretz. If you grow grain on Har Sinai, you will not have to separate, you know, Truma and Maaser. So what gives Har Sinai its sanctity?
Hashem's presence.
Correct, exactly. Right? Revelation. Revelation gives it its sanctity. So that seems to be what's going to happen to Yericho as well. What makes Yericho more holy than the rest of Eretz Yisrael? The answer is going to be that there's revelation happening here. Now, if we look at some of the psukim, we can see other themes which connect the two, which might explain a couple of the stranger things that were happening in the whole Yericho passage. Remember they're told to circle the city for 6 days, and then on the seventh day, they're going to charge. We've also seen Bnei Israel circling something for a long time. That's Har Sinai. And at the end of Parshat Meshpatim, we were told that the cloud rested there for 6 days. And on day number seven, Moshe is called in. Right. So you have a very, very similar situation. 6 days of waiting, and then the seventh day of entering. If we think even of, you know, shofrot in the Rosh Hashanah davening, so the shofar, which plays such a major theme in both Yericho and Har Sinai, the shofar always indicates Hashem's presence, right? That's like what we talk about so much on Rosh Hashanah. You have other pieces as well. The conclusion of the Hashem's presence there is denoted by this phrase Bimshoch Hayovel, right? In Shmos, it's Bimshoch Hayovel Himayelu Bahar. They're going to go in. They're going to go up at the at that phrase Bimshoch Hayovel, referring to the horn as a yovel. Similarly, with the Yoshua Baya Bimshoch Karen Hayovel, that's the phrase that's used. That's when all the people are going to cry out and charge in. We can find other parallels as well. Just one, maybe easy one, is Yahushua tells all the people, right, you're not going to go in. Not only that, you're not going to say anything, right? The people are explicitly told, you're going to be quiet, and you're going to listen. And that's very similar to the experience that Bnei Israel have at Har Sinai, where they're quiet, they sit there, and they listen to the commandments that are coming from Hashem. The Luchot have a key role in Yericho, right, which are taken from Har Sinai and lead the people around the city. The Kohanim play a prominent role in both. For some reason, you know, normally it's the Levim who carry the Aron, but, you know, for some reason the Levim get furloughed, so the Kohanim can carry the Aron. And it's the Kohanim who have gone halfway up Har Sinai are playing an expanded role here as well. So we need to ask, okay, fine, so there are all these connections between Har Sinai and Yericho, so what's going on? So there are, I think, a few points that we can identify. First of all, the giving of the Torah is being compared to the giving of the land, right? That's maybe the most important one. Moshe is the one who receives the Torah, and Yehoshua is the leader whose job is to receive the land. Those are the two holy things that Hashem gives us. He gives us the Torah, right? He gives us Eretz HaKodesh. Those are the two holy things that we receive. And they both are accompanied with a divine revelation. Now, the revelation is totally different at Yericho, because land is, by definition, a physical thing, right? So you may not have the same, you may not hear Hashem's voice, but they're going to see miracles. There is a revelation that that happens here. That's maybe the most important thing. Number two, the fact that there is a revelation, right? The fact that Bnei Israel's first experience in Eretz Israel, notwithstanding everything we said about how important the transition to the natural world is, the beginning of Bnei Israel's existence in the land of Israel still has to involve miraculous divine revelation. They experience Hashem directly when they entered the land before they transition. And one maybe last suggestion that I think we can make, if we draw back to this theme we had identified of Bnei Israel transitioning from an overtly miraculous existence to a naturalistic one, is let's think for a second about what ultimately Bnei Israel's experience with Torah study is all about. It begins with the miraculous. It begins with us passive. It begins with us just receiving Ten Commandments, right? Hashem just says it. It's carved in stone, literally, and that's that. We're passive. We are in a supernatural existence, and that's it. But what is the ultimate course of Torah study? It's not supposed to just be an experience of Aseret HaDibrot and then continuing from there. That's only the first stage of Torah. And then you have a development. Then you have Moshe getting more mitzvot. And then you have us learning. And then you have the transition from Torah Shebichsav to Torah Shebaal Peh. And the involvement of Bnei Yisrael. And the involvement of the human intellect. You have something sacred that is given, and it's given with open revelation and miracles at the beginning, and us being passive, and we have to transition to playing a more active role in the Mesorah. That's what Torah transmission is all about. And then we can point out that the land of Israel, receiving the land, then follows the exact same pattern. It begins with open miracles, it begins with passivity, it begins with clear revelation, and then there's a transition. You think about the way we're supposed to live in the land, where we're living, trying the best we can, right, while also having faith in Hashgachat Hashem. It's really very similar to what we do with Torah Shebaal Peh, where we are trying as hard as we can to decipher and plumb the depths of Torah, and hoping for divine assistance. But we need the effort, and we need the loyalty to the tradition and the Mesorah and the analysis in generation after generation, Moshe and Yehoshua. That, I think, might be why there's such a strong evocation of Sinai at Yericho, because this is another revelation, but this is the one that's kicking off the giving of the land, while Moshe has kicked off the giving of the Torah. And the last piece that I wanted to highlight from our learning from this past week, we think about something that Yehoshua does, and this is a theme which, it happens so many times, it beats us over the head. Yehoshua is obsessed with monuments. He's obsessed with recognizing what Hashem is doing for us, and he is obsessed with making sure that we can transmit that to coming generations. We already saw that last week in Perek Dalet, when the Jews took the 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan River, and those were established at Gilgal. Yehoshua literally makes them the center of his base. He names his base after them. And he says, just like with Yitziat Mitzrayim, you're going to ask your children, and you're going to look at these stones and remember what happened here. Have you noticed how again and again in the Prakim we learned Yehoshua has these big heaps of stones? We're told about these Gal Avanim, which stand Ad Hayom Hazeh. It happens after they execute Achan, which there's so much talk about. Maybe we could do it another time. It happens after they capture the Ai and kill its king. It happens after they capture the five kings in the south. Yehoshua builds all these monuments almost wherever they go to ensure a memory and a recognition and a transition. When they conquer Yericho, so Yehoshua in the middle, you can imagine what the middle of the battle was like. You know, Yehoshua probably had other things to do, but the Navi tells us in Source 23 that Yehoshua takes the time in the middle of the fighting, and he finds those two miraglim from last week, those two spies, and he says, "You find the house of Rachav, and your job is to save her and her family, kasher nishbatem la." They have to do it because even in this moment, Yehoshua is recognizing the importance of Hakrat HaTov. You have to recognize what has been done for you, and you have to appreciate that. Because if we want that to happen on a macro level, with Bnei Yisrael recognizing what Hashem is doing as they come into the land, then we have to start with this happening on a micro level, with what happens with the spies. This comes up again. I put down a couple of sources, you know, towards the end of the sheet. In source 25, Radak explains the reason why all of Yericho had to be Chayrem. They didn't want to get any benefit from any of the land, which leads to the whole Achan sin, is because they wanted it to be like when you separate your first grain, right? Challah, when you grow land in Israel, so you're supposed to separate challah from your dough to recognize that it was given to you by Hashem. So Radak says, yeah, Yeshua of his own volition declares that they can't benefit from the spoils of the first city as a way of getting them to recognize, you know, and remember this is happening from Hashem. Yeshua has that curse at the end of the Yericho battle. Right? And he says, Yericho shall never be rebuilt. And if someone rebuilds it, then they're gonna, when they begin rebuilding it, they'll lose their firstborn, and when they end it, they'll lose their youngest child. What's going on with that? Why does Yeshua find it so important to never rebuild Yericho? So in source 27, Radak quotes the Rambam, and it makes a lot of sense, that Yeshua wanted Yericho to be a permanent ruin so that everyone would see it and would recognize the miracle, appreciate the miracle, and remember what it was that happened here. We can understand then, by the way, why, I don't think, Radak does not make this point, but why Yeshua's curse was the death of children, which we basically never see. Ever. We never see, you know, death of children as a consequence for a sin. I think the reason for it might be, if Yeshua is taking so seriously, as we had in Perek Dalet, the transmission to the next generation. It's very nice you guys here saw this. How is the future going to appreciate what happened? So Yeshua is taking so many steps to ensure the possibility to educate the future. And what's happening if somebody rebuilds Yericho and gets rid of this monument to the miracle that Hashem made? So what he literally is doing by rebuilding Yericho, he's destroying the Jewish future, because he's taking away that educational opportunity. And that's why I think Yeshua's curse is what it is. You know, you can look at Abarbanel. Abarbanel makes a similar point about the dish, about why Yeshua wanted the eye to remain destroyed, because it also needed to serve as a reminder both of the victory that Hashem brought about and of the fact that we messed up the first time and needed Hashem's help. And I think a perfect way to sum up what we've learned this week about Yeshua really is that very first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, that Moshe kibel Torah miSinai umisarel liYeshua v'Yeshua lizkenim, that Yeshua is able to serve as this transitional figure on so many levels. He's the individual who's able to connect to Moshe, he's able to go up to Sinai, but he's also able to disseminate Torah to the masses. He's able to relate to the people, he's able to live both in the world of Har Sinai and in the world of nature of Eretz Yisrael. He's able to make the bridge. And you could say that Yeshua basically is Yeshua's successful attempt to pull off an impossible task. The impossible task being the transition from Moshe as a personality, from Moshe as a relationship with Hashem. Yeshua is the transition from that. And I think we see this this week, looking at how Yeshua conquers the land, the strategy, the tactics, the leadership, combined with the bitachon and the reliance on Hashem. Everything he does at Yericho, all the steps he takes all along the way to make sure, as this is happening, that Bnei Israel can recognize and appreciate what is happening, all of that is serving in the capacity of, ultimately, Moshe kibel Torah misar li Yehoshua, Yehoshua playing that role of bringing us out of Moshe's shadow and into the Jewish future. So